Hello, and welcome to the Badger Talks podcast, the podcast that shares interviews with experts from the University of Wisconsin-Madison community about their work, research, and a little bit about what they're like as people, too. I'm your host, Buzz Kemper. Today's program is The Great Great Lakes and Sea Grant. And I'm happy to have as my guest, Assistant Director for Communications at Wisconsin Sea Grant, Moira Harrington. So Moira, thank you so much for doing this. I have been learning so much from hosting these shows, and I know astonishingly little about the Great Lakes. And there are all kinds of size and just, you know, magnitude statistics that you have in your head. So just give us an idea of the vastness of these lakes.
Right. So not only are the lakes beautiful, and home to hundreds of creatures and are a place for us to recreate, they are an amazing physical presence on our planet. They're the largest freshwater system on the planet. They contain 20% of the Earth's surface water, surface freshwater, and 95% of the surface freshwater in North America.
Wow.
They're an interesting basin because there are five interconnected lakes. So
right.
It's not one separate lake, one separate. They're all interconnected. When we were kids, you know, you heard that mnemonic to remember them. You heard homes.
Yes.
I personally like one. It's more harsh sounding, but then you can remember what the lakes are from west to east. And so if you say, some men hate each other, it's Superior, Michigan.
Okay.
Huron, Erie, and Ontario.
Okay.
And so that just gives you a sweep of how the lakes go from up in Minnesota, from Lake Superior, all the way to the eastern coast of the United States, where we're at Lake Ontario.
Okay.
Where you know, where they hit the, you know, connected by the St. Lawrence Seaway and hit the Atlantic Ocean. They are known as the inland seas, the sweetwater seas, the freshwater seas. And as you see on popular stickers, perhaps you've seen on bumpers around town or on somebody's laptop or water bottle, they're unsalted and shark-free. Despite that, people can surf in the Great Lakes, and people do. So that's just one example of the great recreation available to you on the Great Lakes.
Wow, freshwater surfing. I had not known about that. So how, I know you're not a geologist,
correct,
but I bet you can answer this question. How were they formed? Why do we have those amazing bodies of water in this part of the world?
And you can thank the glaciers for that.
Okay, thank you, glaciers.
Thank you, glaciers. Receding and moving forward glaciers back and forth, and just the ice sheets when they melted. I wish I could remember how many thousands and thousands of years ago, but I don't. But they've been around a long time.
A long time.
Yeah.
Let's just talk a little bit about the wildlife. We all know that on different bodies of land, there are different kinds of animals. We don't have panthers, in Madison, Wisconsin. When it comes to freshwater lakes in different parts of the country or different parts of the world, are there specific types of marine life that we will find in one lake but not in another? Or is it kind of more just mixed up?
Yeah, because the lakes are interconnected, the species will be similar. Now,
okay.
Lake Superior is the largest lake, obviously,
right,
the coldest, the deepest. It's actually the largest lake in the world by surface area.
Wow.
So Lake Baikal in Russia is actually a deeper lake, but it doesn't have as much surface area.
Okay.
But it doesn't have as much nutrients in it to support as varied of an ecosystem in there.
Okay.
But still, within the Great Lakes, we'd like to say there's more than 3,500 species of plants and animals. So interesting freshwater fish. A particularly interesting fish that was in the news just this week is the lake sturgeon. So
okay.
These are known as the dinosaur fish. These are prehistoric fish. They can grow to be 8 feet long. They can live close to 200 years. And in Wisconsin, we have the world's healthiest population of lake sturgeon because of the efforts of people who want to conserve them. Some of my coworkers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Aquatic Sciences Center, which is what we are a part of, which maintains the Wisconsin Sea Grant College program, focusing on the Great Lakes, and then the Water Resources Institute, which focuses more on groundwater. But I have a colleague who has worked with biologists at the Department of Natural Resources for years to understand the sturgeon, to help restore them. They're very important to the indigenous people in Wisconsin, so he's worked with tribes. And that's just a point of pride for us, that we can help these great, amazing dinosaur fish survive. Now, they're found in other parts of the Great Lakes, but here in Wisconsin, boy, we really knock it out of the park when it comes to take care of those.
All right.
And they've been in the news this week because they were under consideration for being placed on the endangered species list.
Oh, really?
And there was just a decision yesterday that came out that said, no, we won't do that. And people in Wisconsin were concerned about that. People in Wisconsin, the population is so healthy that people catch them, and they're good eating.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were concerned about, again, what the Great Lakes mean to their way of life, the tradition of sturgeon spearing through the ice.
Yeah. Well, I know that's a big deal on Lake Winnebago.
Correct.
Which is connected to the Great Lakes. Yeah, and it's also known as a pretty shallow lake.
Right.
And so that's why you can spear them in that lake, you know, fairly easily. But although the fishermen might not say it's so easy, but the sturgeon do not then require a shallow water, apparently, if they're also in Lake Superior.
Yeah,
They're apparently...
They're in all the lakes.
They're in all the lakes.
Right.
Wow,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's an example.
Okay.
And I don't know, maybe we want to get into a little bit about the species that are not native to the Great Lakes.
Let's talk about that.
Which there are, you know, more than 180 non-native species that have come to the Great Lakes.
Okay, and I imagine that brings problems.
That does bring problems.
Okay.
One thing I like to kind of remind myself and remind other people about, like, well, we don't need to demonize these species. They're just doing their thing. They're just, you know, they're just there. They didn't ask to come, you know, perhaps
right.
in the ballast water of an international ship that came through the St. Lawrence Seaway, and then the ocean-going ship from the Baltic Sea perhaps released its ballast water, and then with it, all the creatures that were living in that water that came from Europe. So, for example, a small creature called a spiny water flea, which, you know, fish will eat, and it's spiny, and it will kind of rip up their internal organs, so that's not good. We've all heard of Asian carp.
Yes.
Those do not come from overseas. Those were probably brought to the southern part of the United States to be used in outdoor aquaculture operations to kind of keep the water clean, because as carp, they're bottom feeders and they'll sort of keep these ponds clean. But because the Mississippi River Basin and the Great Lakes Basin is artificially connected through the Chicago Sanitary Ship Canal, system.
This I did not know.
The Mississippi River and the Great Lakes were never connected, but they are because there's this channel. When the city of Chicago kind of re-engineered its wastewater system from, you know, the 1800s, and they put their sewage into the river and then dug this canal. And so it flows out of the city instead of into the city and then through this canal, and it connects the Mississippi and the Great Lakes. And so the Asian carp escaped from these ponds in the south and swam up the Mississippi River. So now people are concerned they're voracious eaters. What does that mean for the whole food web in the entire Great Lakes? So those are two examples. What my colleagues do as part of Wisconsin Sea Grant, part of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is we have extension agents. So just like if you are a farmer and you want to know how to increase your milk yield, you fund research on a campus, you learn these great techniques, and then you have extension staff who go out and visit with individual farmers or work with industry to share that knowledge, part of that Wisconsin idea,
right.
You know, that the research doesn't just stay on campus, it gets shared without. We have that same thing with our program.
Also, keeping with that Wisconsin idea the connection, you are also helping with pollution problems, right? We
Correct.
Have plastics and other
right.
problems. I mean, I would love to just spend the whole time talking about all the beauty and wonder of the Great Lakes, but
right.
we need to talk a little bit about the icky stuff too, because
yeah.
that's how we can prevent it.
Correct.
So what is being discovered and taught in terms of plastics and just other garbage and other contaminants.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate part of our society, isn't it? We use the water and we abuse the water sometimes, but I'm grateful that I work for an organization, again, at University of Wisconsin-Madison, where we fund research projects. So part of our name is Grant, C. Grant. And every 2 years, we run a competition and say, hey, researchers, what are your good ideas to address some of these problems? So we end up funding about 11 research projects every 2 years. They aren't all focused on these emerging contaminants, is the phrase, but that's definitely an area we do like to focus on. And so, for example, right now, we're funding people who are studying PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. They've been in the news a lot.
Is that PFAS?
Yes, okay. PFAS, PFAS. And they are chemicals, right? So they're chemicals that people invented in the 1950s and onward. They do great things for our lives. You know, they are they're a part of our non-stick cookware. They're on our clothing to prevent stain repellents. They're on our furniture to prevent stains. They're used in firefighting foam. So you want to prevent fires, but PFAS are a part of that. Well, they don't break down in the environment there. They're known as the forever chemical.
Wow. So they don't. So you can't even give a number to a half-life.
Correct.
It's really. Wow.
I mean, there's thousands of them. There's more than 9,000 of these different chemical compounds. Some probably do break down very slowly. Others don't. So my boss, our director at Wisconsin Sea Grant, is actually probably the leading PFAS researcher in the state of Wisconsin, and she studies how they move around. She recently was able to work with Congressman Mark Pocan, who brought nearly $1 million to the University of Wisconsin-Madison to start a PFAS Center of Excellence. So she will collaborate with her fellow researchers who are looking at emerging contaminants like PFAS. She studies how they move around, but she might know somebody elsewhere on campus who studies how many are there, what are they, how do they act in when they're in the sediment of a lake bed, how do they move through groundwater. So she's going to use this Center of Excellence to bring people together to share research, which they do to a certain extent. Definitely already. She's going to be able to buy some new instrumentation, so they'll be able to run samples more quickly and get more different types of samples in, because like I said, there's more than 9,000 of these chemicals. So, you know, what do we know about each one of those 9,000? Not a lot. And they're not great chemicals to have around because they're, you know, yet another one of these that cause cancer and other health issues. And as my director has said, wherever we look for these, whether it's in the rain, whether it's in the surface water, whether it's in the soil, we find them. So they're everywhere. So it's a discouraging thing to know about, but yet there's opportunity here. There's hope. She's working really hard to solve that.
Yeah, we have to know the bad news in order to try to correct it. Yeah,
that will help determine what the cleanup plan is. She has served on the governor's task force on PFAS, and so she's helped state policymakers understand this, and then, again, that will guide how we can clean them up.
Is it a pre- and post thing? In other words, can we not only work on how to properly dispose of these chemicals, but also encourage science to come up with alternatives to these chemicals so we don't have them in the first place? It's a double-edged sword?
Yes. Yeah, I think how you just said it right there, Buzz, is the exact way to say it. Are there ways we can get these sort of effects without creating more of these chemicals, putting more of these chemicals out in the world? Can we make firefighting foam without using these chemicals? I'm no scientist, but yeah, you could work on that. There are a lot of smart people out there. And then now that they're out there, how do we figure out how to clean them up? So yeah, it's coming at it in both directions. I will say, if I can, I'll just go on with this theme, that there's reason for optimism. So, you know, many years ago, we used to hear about PCBs, right? And I'm from Wisconsin, perhaps you're from Wisconsin, but I know the whole corridor of the Fox Valley, up and down the Fox River, the world's largest concentration of paper-making plants. And one of the sad legacies of that industry that supported families and provided jobs and created products for us that we all used and appreciated was this PCB contamination. Again, cancer-causing, again, disrupting of ecosystems. Based on research that the two programs I work for, the Sea Grant Institute and the Water Resources Institute at UW-Madison, again, this Wisconsin idea, they worked with researchers, huge research teams from the US EPA, Fish and Wildlife Service, Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and did foundational research, primarily in the 1970s up to the 1990s, to understand how bad is this problem and how can we clean it up. And in about the year 2020, it was done. It was the world's largest cleanup of PCBs. It's estimated to have cost $1.2 billion.
Okay.
But I think, you know, the river's cleaner, the fish are healthier, the wildlife is healthier, it's safer for people. So it's a thorny problem that goes back years, but they stopped making the PCB products.
Right.
They stopped dumping it in the water, and now we're at a point where we've cleaned it up. So it's a rough thing to go through,
right,
but there's precedent for hope, I think.
That's wonderful. Good. Yeah, yeah. I love hearing the good news.
Yeah.
And and that's one of the sayings I love is the only thing that beats science is better science.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're doing here. What is unique about the Great Lakes as opposed to smaller lakes? I imagine that we don't just have the same exact problems, but on different scales, although maybe that's the case. But I would imagine that the Great Lakes present their own unique challenges, opportunities, problems. I mean, obviously,
right,
the opportunities are amazing, like,
right,
like, you know, shipping from, you
correct
know, long distances.
Right.
But can you talk a little bit about that? What are some of the unique challenges?
Yeah, right. I guess I would say that, again, not being a scientist, wish I had three or four of my colleagues sitting here with me and they could each jump in with their coastal engineering advice. And
you could have brought them in. We have more
microphones. I should
have.
Yeah, we have a big studio here. I wish I would have. But one thing I will say is that the lakes act more like a saltwater ocean, and certainly more so than perhaps an inland lake
I would
does
think so, yeah.
I mean, for example, we've all heard of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the large ore freighter that sunk, and mm-hmm. Gordon Lightfoot mm-hmm. did an earworm song about. I like that song, though.
Yeah.
But there's been speculation that the waves, that the storm that that boat was traveling through, the waves were 30 feet high.
Yeah.
So, things that you would see on the ocean. You would not expect to see that out on Lake Mendota in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I would hope
that
not.
High. I would hope not.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it would probably
be an
apocalyptic event if that
correct
were the case.
So the weather on the lakes can be like that. And just having waves, there's, you know,
yeah,
wave action. There are tsunamis on the Great Lakes. They're called meteo tsunamis. They're not obviously caused by an earthquake, but by storms.
Meteo. Say that again.
Meteo tsunamis.
So
meteorological tsunamis.
Oh,
tsunamis.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Thank you. That clarifies. Okay.
There's been documented cases of these enormous waves caused by a storm system passing over the lake, and then it spawns up these waves. Again, I wish I had my colleague here who's studied these.
You're doing fine.
but they've, you know, caused tremendous property damage and have taken lives, sadly.
Yeah.
There's some things, properties of the Great Lakes.
Right. Well, yeah, we'll be doing a show specifically on the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Oh, interesting.
So I am really, yeah, looking forward to that because I don't know much outside of the song. Thank you,
right,
Gordon Lightfoot.
Right.
Terrific. What would you like to say about the Great Lakes or really fascinates you about the Great Lakes, but perhaps I haven't asked the right question to address?
Well, maybe I'll go in two directions just for a minute.
Do
here.
It.
And I'll try to remember in my head what two directions I want to go, but both related to the waves and shipwrecks and the Edmund Fitzgerald. First of all, the waves. So there's a researcher on the Madison campus who we've funded in the past who studies these rogue waves, these freak waves. And an approach he has taken is putting a sensor on the bottom of Lake Superior, on the bottom of Lake Michigan. I mentioned Lake Superior, probably that's a good one to talk about. Because this summer, the Friends of the Apostle Islands is helping to fundraise to put buoys on the lakes near the Apostle Islands chain. a very popular place for recreationalists to go and kayak to the islands, the 20-plus islands up there, to go into the sea caves that are along the mainland shore. But it's dangerous. So where you put in to kayak, you can't see where you might be kayaking to because of the shape of the shoreline. So the sensor on the lake bed, again, funded by UW-Madison, again, an example of the Wisconsin idea, is helping to save lives because the sensor is connected to computer terminals, and it is feeding out data on what are the wave heights out here, what is the water temperature, and so people can check a kiosk before they put their kayaks in at Myers Beach, and then know what the conditions are if they want to go out or not. Is it safe or not? So you can get like real time information.
Yeah. So you can do the math. 30-foot wave. I have a 7-foot kayak. Right. I think I'm going to stay home.
I'm a tiny human being.
Yeah, right.
I'll let Mother Nature do what it's doing out there, and I won't be a part of it today. So I love that because that's literally saving people's lives. People have lost their lives kayaking in the Great Lakes, particularly up there. So that's one. The other direction I was going to go in talking about waves and shipwrecks is that another rewarding part of what I enjoy talking about and working with the maritime archaeologists at the Wisconsin Historical Society. So Wisconsin Sea Grant has funded that program through grants at the Historical Society for probably 35 years, just a succession of maritime archaeologists. And they study the more than 700 known shipwrecks in Lakes Superior and Lakes Michigan, the Great Lakes waters that surround Wisconsin. And they're just a great window to our past.
Yeah.
You know, just a great vehicle for storytelling.
Yeah.
We maintain a website in partnership with them. It's called wisconsinshipwrecks.org. So all run together, wisconsinshipwrecks.org. Mm-hmm. And it's just got great historical photos, you know, very interesting stories, what's happened with these ships. And then the maritime archaeologists work to write up narratives about them and submit them to the National Register of Historic Places. And then they're protected. They have extra protection.
Excellent.
And so we learn more about them. We learn about those people and how, again, how that shaped Wisconsin's culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you familiar with shipwreck diver Tamara Thompson?
You bet.
Okay.
Yeah.
She's a good friend of mine.
Oh, I didn't know
she's
that.
She's actually my sister's like best friend. And
How about that?
So we have become friends through that.
And I also like the shipwreck aspect of why I think what she does is amazing and her colleagues through the years. And but we also like to talk about shipwrecks because they're a springboard to talk about other, again, going back to the lakes.
Yeah.
You know, when we were talking a little bit ago about the invasive species, we didn't really start talking too much about the different mussels that have invaded, particularly Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
So your experience diving.
Zebra?
The
mussels particularly?
Zebra and quagga mussels.
Okay.
So quagga mussels are sort of like version 2.0 of the zebra mussels because they can adhere to softer surfaces.
Mm.
The zebra mussels came in and they could only adhere to rocks or intake pipes for water treatment plants or something.
Right, right.
The quaggas can be on the bottom of the lake bed. So there's trillions of them, you know. Anyway, because they're filter feeders, they're filtering out all the phytoplankton at the base of the food web in the lake, and they're clearing the lake. And so you can see your shipwrecks more easily. You can dive and see things more easily, but it's totally disrupted what it means to be a fish and the whole ecosystem in the lake.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I bet. Yeah, it's so amazing how a little creature like that can just, you know, change the course of everything. Yeah. It's like the emerald ash borer in trees, you know.
Correct.
It's just like all of a sudden, like, where are the birds going to live? Yeah. Crazy stuff. Is it possible that these mussels will eventually eat themselves out of existence? If you're saying they're clearing, they're clearing all this plant life out, that is their food source as well as the bottom of the food chain.
Correct.
Is it possible that they just might eat themselves out of existence?
Could be.
Okay.
But that would sure be a depressing thing for the food
web. It would be depressing.
That would be a total collapse.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Well, let's just jump into what do you do when you're not studying this stuff, not being an assistant communications director?
Right.
For,
well, I love my
Secret.
Job. Yeah,
I'm sure you
I
do.
I just love my
job. But what do you do for fun?
Let's see. I serve on the board of the Madison Park Commissioners as a volunteer.
Okay.
That's really very interesting. We have citizen members on that board, and then we have some elected alders who join us, and we, you know, help make decisions about the 270 parks in the city of Madison.
Yeah.
Which I enjoy that.
That's, I didn't realize it was that many. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
It's pretty awesome.
All right.
I'm a beekeeper. I'm a new beekeeper.
Oh, my
gosh.
So
when I leave here today, I'm going to go see how my hive is. I only have one hive.
Okay.
We'll see how it's doing.
Oh, wow.
I had to buy new bees this year because they didn't overwinter from last year.
Oh.
So I put new bees in.
Okay.
But I did it last Friday. And if you remember, the weather last Friday was windy and cold.
Yes.
So I'm not sure how they're going to be doing.
Okay.
But I'm going to put on my suit and smoke them and go see how. Crack open their hive and see how they're doing.
See how they're doing. Yeah. Wow. That is really fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow. What got you interested in that? Because most people are just, you know, pet. I mean, they'll mm-hmm. they'll run away screaming. You
right,
know?
Right. Yeah. I think I probably, you know, like we hear about the decline of pollinators.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are non-native bees, too. Well, if you want to talk about non-native, honeybees are not native.
Right.
But it's just fascinating to me. And why not get more pollinators out in the world?
Yeah.
And, my husband keeps saying, we need to get more hives and you need to harvest more honey so we can make mead. And I said, well, I'm not in it for the mead.
Yeah.
I'm just in it for the interesting bee life. Yeah, but,
I got to kind of side with your husband on this one.
Yeah. I mean, I could just go buy some mead.
I'm a fan of the mead. I haven't had any recently, but that's great. Are you going to sell honey or are you just doing this for yourself?
No, it's just for myself.
And, okay.
Yeah. It's
all
fine.
All right. If you go into business, let me know.
I'll
buy some. Cool.
Right.
All right. Good deal. Moira Harrington, this has been really, really enlightening and clarifying. Thank you so much for being on the program.
All right. Thanks for having me, Buzz.
You've been listening to the Badger Talks podcast. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Assistant Director for Communications at Wisconsin Sea Grant, Moira Harrington. Please browse our previous episodes for other topics that may be of interest to you. The Badger Talks podcast is a creation of UW Connects and produced at Audio for the Arts Recording Studios in Madison, Wisconsin. Our music is composed by Bill Purdy and performed by the UW Marching Band. I'm Buzz Kemper. Thank you for listening.